Okay. Well, I've been looking forward to this meeting for a long time because I want to get something from it, but I also realize that this is my opportunity to give something to it here. I'm an experimentalist, so I'm not going to be able to contribute too much to the theory, but what I want to do in this talk, this presentation, is talk about a possible alternative opportunity to do attosecond science, but at a completely different attosecond source. So we've heard a lot about the atomic physics-based sources and the laser-driven sources. Now this is now a third way of creating very, very short pulses of electromagnetic radiation. This picture is, you know, of course, an artist's conception of the sort of business end of an X-ray free electron laser that will exist in starting in a couple of years at Stanford. And so it's what goes on in here that I'm going to be talking about. There's some references, and I mostly put these here because then they'll be in the online version, and you can see these. This is a complete conceptual design report of an X-ray free electron laser, and this talks about experiments. And then I also want to point out that on Friday, Sasha Zolins will be here, and in a sense, he's going to give a talk that will lead on directly from what I say here. So the X-ray free electron lasers, none of which exist now, but they're going to be built in Germany and Japan and at Stanford, are all based on linear accelerators with very, very long undulators producing coherent radiation at the end. This is the design parameters for LCLS, and you see this one, this particular design parameter makes it look like we're way, way out of the regime of having any impact on attoscience. And that isn't actually true. The importance is in the details, and that's why I think this is going to be kind of a pedagogical talk. I want to make sure that everybody understands what the light is like from these and how you can really consider these as sources for attoscience. So I'll explain, in order to do this, I have to explain what an XFEL is to my laser buddies who don't really like what lasers in an XFEL, for example. And then by doing that, I'll describe the gain process, which naturally leads to sub-femtosecond pulses, in fact, in these machines through a concept called the cooperation length. And then methods for coherent pulse width reduction to get that 200 femtosecond specification down to something that we might be able to use for short timescale science, and then the experimental challenges and research opportunities. Obviously, all of this is in a kind of compressed version. So what is a free electron laser? What lasers after all? Well, it's a relativistic electron beam and an electromagnetic wave that becomes the laser wave, the laser light, that co-propagate through an oscillating magnetic field. So in a sense, it doesn't look that much different from what Don Umstetter was talking about with different ways of combining electromagnetic radiation and oscillating charged particles. The relevant parameters, of course, are the electron energy. Everything's relativistic here. The wavelength of the radiation, the undulator period, and the RMS magnetic field. And you put these things together in the right way, and you get the parameters of the machine. This is what it looks like. This is about the only baby picture that I have here. This is what one of those undulators look like. This is the trajectory of an electron in microns as it goes through the oscillating magnetic fields of the undulator. So when you think about a laser, you kind of think, well, what's the upper laser level and what's the lower laser level? Somehow there's kind of a resonance condition. And what's the resonance condition in a free electron laser goes like this. The electrons and the light are in resonance. The relativistic electrons and the light are, of course, traveling together, but the electrons don't go as fast, and they also don't go in a straight line. So resonance occurs when the electrons slip one optical wavelength after each undulator period. And you kind of put all that in a formula, and you see here's the resonance condition, here's the lasing wavelength, the undulator period, this is the relativistic gamma factor. This parameter K is the wiggle parameter. It tells you the angle of maximum deviation times gamma. And it also is, in fact, numerically equal to the vector potential normalized to MC. Then there's this third term, which this is the angle of deviation away from the axis. This shows that the electrons also slip behind if they're not going straight, if the light and the electrons are not going the same direction. Okay. So the light itself, of course, comes from this wiggling. In other words, it comes from synchrotron radiation produced by the magnetic fields turning the electrons. And of course, this idea is an old one. Undulators have existed before. The undulator resonance condition is the same as the FEL resonance condition. The undulator bandwidth, that is the width of radiation coming out, is related to the number of periods in just the usual, you know, coherence formula way. And the photons that come out are diffraction limited in the usual way. So the question is, why is an FEL, why do we even talk about an FEL? Why is it just different from an undulator? And the reason is because of the idea of coherence, of course. It's a coherent source of light. So we think about it like this. Here is an electron going through an undulator. And, of course, it wiggles. And every once in a while, it produces a photon. But photons that are produced on different undulator bends but with the same electron are produced in phase because of that resonance condition. That's the way an undulator works. But, of course, photons that are produced by different electrons are out of phase. And so the radiation that comes out of an undulator, there's no coherence from one electron to the other. They're in a sense, incoherent sources in that sense. But, in fact, they're completely incoherent, really, because they're weak radiators. The average number of photons per electron is way less than one in an undulator. So, in fact, no two photons are coherently related in an undulator. In order to get that coherence, you need to somehow get the electrons bunched so that they're all kind of in the same place with respect to this to the radiation that they're producing. And you can see that in this plot of how the undulator power changes as you increase the wavelength, the period of the wavelength, until it becomes as long as the electron bunch length. You see that as that wavelength gets longer and longer, at some point the power produced by the radiator just takes off. And the reason, of course, is because you get into a regime where all these electric fields are adding, and therefore the intensity goes like m squared. And so there's this n squared. That's the number of electrons. You get an n squared enhancement because of that coherence. So we need to get that bunching to occur. And that bunching then turns an undulator into an FEL. So there's a schematic picture showing that. So how do you get the bunching to occur? Well, the good news is that it happens automatically. The reason is because of that resonance condition again. So let's just consider these cartoons that show what happens to a couple of different electrons that are at different spatial locations with respect to the radiation they're producing in the undulator field. So the electron that is red actually will accelerate on every cycle, because when the undulator is causing it to be transversely deflected up, it's also traveling along with an electromagnetic field that is forcing it in the same direction. On the other hand, half cycle later, when it's being forced down, because of the resonance condition, the field is also slipped by a half period so that it's forcing it down. And so it just gets accelerated on every cycle. The green electron is in a slightly different place, so it decelerates on every cycle. So if you take a lot of originally randomly located electrons and see what happens to them, well, every half period, what happens to them reverses sign. So these red electrons get accelerated, and the green electrons get decelerated, and after a while you have bunching, and then that's the condition you need. So this will all happen all by itself. Now, of course, the fact that we want radiation out of this means that we have to modify this very slightly, because if you think about it, the decelerated electrons are giving energy back to the field, so they're producing laser light for us. But the accelerated electrons are taking light away from the field, so they're subtracting light that we want to see at the back end. And so we want to make sure that there's more getting decelerated, producing gain, than getting accelerated, producing loss. And that means that we need to somehow cheat, push some detuning above resonance into our resonance condition. We don't want to sit on the resonance condition, but slightly above it. There's a theorem associated with the inventor of the free electron laser, Mady, about this, showing how you want to. This is just the nice little Fraunhofer pattern of how much radiation is produced as a function of detuning in the in an undulator. And you see, you want to sit right on this very, very steep edge here of that resonance condition for the undulator, and then you'll get the maximum gain. So that's how it works. Now, you know, you want to do this right, rigorously. Go see this paper, which you can jot that down or look at it on the web later, which we'll go through this in detail. Everything ends up depending on something called the FEL parameter rho, which has all of these properties that you need to optimize in order to get the most gain. What rho is that the gain per undulator radian that you go through, and I'm getting to the short pulse stuff. It's about to happen. I don't have to go through this in great detail, but to show you that, for example, this gain depends on the ratio of the beam plasma frequency, very much the same parameter as Don was talking about in the previous talk, to the undulator frequency. And it also depends on the normalized vector potential. You need to get that as high as possible. So it helps to have a lot of density, helps to have a lot of bunching, it helps to have a lot of field. Okay? It also helps to have your light always kind of stay in the same place as the electrons. And so you need to have the beam emittance for the electrons be on the order of or smaller than the undulator radiation emittance. That's what this picture shows. And it also helps to have the gain length of your system be shorter than the Rayleigh length of the radiation. So you have to kind of combine all of these things. And of course, there's the detuning. So you do everything optimally, and there's this beautiful simulation that shows what happens. This is following along with some initially unbunched electrons as they go through a long undulator. This was done by a UCLA group, and this will kind of cycle through a couple of times. But you can see that what happens is that self-bunching occurs. At the point when self-bunching occurs, suddenly there's an awful lot of radiation happening, which decelerates the electrons, and you'll see that that turns the process off. See, there's the bunching, and whoops, look at all those electrons slipping back. They've given their lives so that we can have laser light. That's the way I look at it. So, what stops the FEL from going on forever? Well, it's this thing called the cooperation length. It's the fact that the electrons slip one X-ray period every undulator period, and so it's the slippage over an entire gain length that's the maximum coherency you can have, and that kind of sets the length of a coherence spike. The radiation builds up with coherence spikes of on the order of this is a radian, so on the order of 2 pi times that length. And how long that is, it can be quite short. It's less than a femtosecond at the XFEL that's being built at Stanford, the LCLS. So if you look in a simulation at the light coming out as a function of making the undulator longer and longer, and it starts to laze, you begin to see this happening. These are plots of the intensity versus distance through the bunch of electrons at different points in the undulator chain. Here we are, the exponential gain portion of the laser is here. You see this is power going up on a log scale. And initially, you just have a lot of stochastic-looking spikes of radiation. Then you start getting bunching, and you get these coherent spikes of radiation. Then you get saturation. And this is 2.5 femtoseconds, so these are sub-femtosecond spikes. So those are our attosecond pulses. Here's the parameters for LCLS. 25 nanometers is our cooperation length, so that's significantly shorter than a femtosecond. Now, on the other hand, where did the 200 femtoseconds come from in the spec? The bunch is a lot longer than one spike long. And in fact, it's about 300 spikes long, which means that it's a very noisy source. It's a lot of little spikes. Each one is very short, but there's a lot of them. It's not a regular pulse train. It's a train like the simulation showed. So there are some control strategies. Sasha Zolins is going to give a whole talk on control strategies, and so that's why I wanted to do this introduction in advance. Some of the control strategies are just naturally being done anyway in order to get the beam parameters that we need to get the thing to laze. One of them is electron bunch compression. Electron bunch compression is basically just taking advantage of the fact that once the beam is ultra-relativistic, it's stiff. You can no longer change its length, but you can sure change its energy. So So by accelerating it in an RF accelerator that is off the crest so that the head of the bunch and the tail see a different longitudinal electric field, you introduce an energy chirp, very, very familiar to all of us ultrafast laser guys. And then that chirp can be compressed by going through a set of dipole magnets, just like going through a set of prisms. And so we can create compression this way. Now, this is also a control device, because right here in the middle of it, we've turned longitudinal space into transverse space. And so we can put some kind of a filter here and do that and thereby control the shape of the bunch or other properties of the bunch. And that's one of the strategies for trying to reduce the spikiness or get just a few spikes of laser radiation out. This particular strategy has been developed by Paul Emma, who's one of the research scientists building the LCLS at Stanford. And so here he is right in the middle of this so-called chicane, this dipole magnet array that does the compression. And he notes that there is a close correlation between the longitudinal position out here and the horizontal position right here of the beam. And so now we could put a little filter there, and we could just get a very, very short electron bunch that way and presumably get fewer spikes in our radiation. His idea is to just add a very thin slotted foil at that point that's so thin that the electrons actually all make it through, but the ones that have to go through the foil instead of through the slot get slight small angle scattering to mess up the emittance of the beam at those points. And then what will happen is that the conditions you need for lasing will only be satisfied in the slot, but all the charge will still be there that you need for things like wake field compression and all of the other fancy stuff that they do in the LINAC. Here's what he calculates using his FEL code would be the output power from the X-ray free electron laser as a function of time. This is the power that comes just from the electron, where the electrons are. This is, in a sense, the incoherent power. But all of the laser radiation, he claims, could come in a little 2 femtosecond spike. So these are the sorts of schemes that people are thinking of to control things. You can also, he actually wrote a paper where he got a little fancy and talked about pulse length control with a stepping motor and things that we could do. And that's not the only thing. Zollens will talk about a lot more. So let me switch gears now and talk about the experiments, again with an eye towards attosecond research. First of all, point out that a big project like this, a lot of people are involved in thinking about experiments, and you've got to write them down. And so we have a book that describes the first experimental plans, and there are five science thrust areas: coherent photon scattering, AMO physics, pump probe diffraction dynamics, high energy density science, and single molecule imaging. And a number of these have very, very short time duration dynamics that could be investigated if we had or created the capabilities with the XFEL to do so. The unique aspects, of course, of the machine are high peak power. I haven't really talked about that, but this is a millijoule of X-rays in this couple hundred femtoseconds or less, high coherence compared to synchrotron radiation, which we did talk about, and then the short spikes. The challenges to doing attoscience is, first of all, we have to be able to handle very high intensities of X-rays. Synchronization to laser sources is going to be a tremendous challenge, and the large fluctuations in the time structure. So let me now make some specific comments about that. First of all, we did some experiments to look into time structure jitter issues. I just want to point out, this is sort of a bogus thing, but it's kind of fun to say anyway, that 1 femtosecond synchronization is what we would like to have, of course, sort of carrier envelope stabilization kind of synchronization. Well, that's equivalent to controlling the arrival of the electron bunch to a part in 10 billion of its total travel down the LINAC. So it's not something that sort of you get automatically. And in fact, we did some early measurements using just the existing slack LINAC and a single undulator to try to analyze the timing jitter in the electrons coming down the LINAC, And we did that using electro-optic sampling. This describes it. This is Adrian Cavalieri's thesis. He's the guy who has done that solid-state physics experiment in Ferenc Krauss's group, and so it's great to see his name coming up again. But what he did was he said, okay, let's just take this ultra-relativistic electron bunch that's coming down the slack linac, and we'll put a little thin electro-optic crystal there so that it's the electron's field perturbs the index of refraction of the crystal, and then we'll sample it with the synchronized laser that's supposed to be exactly in synchronization with this electron and see how synchronized they are. And here's a movie showing the electro-optic sampling polarization data. There goes the electron bunch, and you can see all the jitter. And so what Adrian showed was, well, he was able to characterize the jitter and also characterize to a large extent the compression of this electron bunch, which was critical for helping understand whether the designs for beam compression for LCLS would work. He also, of course, by doing that measurement, gives us a way of finding out what the timing is, and we can use that to locate when the X-rays come in pump probe experiments. So without discussing too much the physics that was being done here, which is pretty fascinating, but nonetheless, this picture shows this is real time. We ran at 10 hertz. We collected data. Every time an X-ray pulse came, we didn't know what time it came except by looking at the electro-optic sampling picture, which is this one. We could use that to locate the position on the x-axis and then build up over time a randomly sampled histogram of whatever the transient thing was we were looking at. In this case, it was the excitation of optical phonons in bismuth films, which is an interesting subject in itself. But here I just want to do this to show the timing. Well, here's that data again with, carefully analyzed with circles and arrows to show what kind of information you can collect. The problem here, though, is that the XFEL X-rays, the ones that come out of the laser, are not actually going to follow the shape of the electron bunch. So just knowing when the electrons came is not enough. You're not going to know just from the electrons came, because the electrons get rebunched going through the undulator. So the technique won't work at attosecond timescales, although it's going to be marvelous at femtosecond timescales at LCLS. So what other technique could we use to get down to attosecond levels? Well, there's this other technique that's used typically for these short pulse X-ray sources, single shot determinations of timing. So the way that works is that the short pulse phenomenon that you want to induce with a laser and then probe with the X-rays, you induce with a laser that's not going collinear with the X-rays, but it's off-axis. So the point where the laser excites the sample and the X-rays probe the sample, the relative timing changes at different spatial locations. And then just by viewing this sample really carefully, you can see at different points of the sample different conditions for laser pump X-ray probe. You look at the X-rays coming from different places. This is what a line-out of this crystal looks like. Here are the X-rays diffracted from different parts of the surface of this crystal on a single pulse of the undulator. And here is what that same thing looks like if a laser did some physics right here and interrupted the diffraction. This happened to be melting, so it's a dramatic difference in diffracted intensity that you see. But in fact, what's important is to look carefully here and say, well, how good spatial definition do I have here? Because it's like a street camera. Space along this axis is time in your experiment. Well, here's some lineouts showing that particular data, and you can look at this in two ways. First of all, you can try to get physics out of it, which is what most of this slide is about. I pulled it from another talk. That the physics all comes from the details of the shape of this lineout. This shows how the diffraction intensity changes with time. Okay. But you can also analyze this by saying, well, what kind of spatial resolution do I need to get what kind of temporal resolution? And it turns out that if I want femtosecond resolution, it isn't totally impossible. A few microns of spatial resolution can buy me the temporal resolution that I need. So this is a possibility, but of course it puts restrictions on what kind of an experiment you can do, because you'll need to have some distributed sample that you can look at on single shots. Okay, now the third thing that we can investigate, another thing that we can investigate in the attosecond time regime is, of course, strong field phenomena. Because we have a lot of photons that are all writhing at the same time. Strong fields induced by the X-rays or by a laser, but mostly I'll talk about the X-rays here. So, for example, there's all this nonlinear atomic physics producing hollow atoms by cleaning out inner shells on timescales that are faster than Auger processes, or multiphoton processes, getting things to happen that require cooperativity and coherence between the X-rays. And then, a third idea, which is sort of related to these, but of course is more in the realm of molecular physics, is or cluster physics, is looking at giant Coulomb explosions and trying to find out what happens on the earliest timescales there. Now, I've got a simulation of that. This is the explosion of a cluster. This is a T4 lysozyme. And then this is 200 femtoseconds unfolding here on this clock. It'll recycle. So as that clock goes around, 200 femtoseconds goes by. Now, it's interesting to point out that a lot of junk happens by the end, but stuff starts happening right away. And on the electronic scale, of course, we're just looking at the locations of ions here, not the locations of electrons. There certainly is a lot of information that we could get very, very early. This is a 10 to the 11 watt per square centimeter radiation per 200 femtoseconds in a 1 millimeter spot. That's the unfocused output of the XFEL hitting that lysozyme. Okay, we can also focus the beam, do focused beam experiments. And with focused beam experiments, we do expect to find regimes where we can photoionize on timescales comparable to the Auger decay rate. And so that suggests then that it would be extremely advantageous to have attosecond timescales for exploring that process. That's been discussed a lot in this conference already. And then finally, the final area I want to touch on is high energy density science experiments with LCLS. We've heard some about from Rick Freeman and others about high energy density science experiments. The point about LCLS is that with this many X-rays, you can, first of all, view rather dense samples while they're undergoing the heating that happens with these very very high energy lasers, and we hope to have lasers on site that will be able to induce warm dense matter conditions that can be probed then by the X-rays. So we can either pump with the X-rays or pump with a laser. If we pump with the laser, we can probe with the X-rays. If we pump with the X-rays, we can actually heat volumetrically heat samples because of the deep penetration. And so both of those kinds of modalities will be explored. And in both of those cases, we're going to be producing dynamics in the system that are on a scale that will be interesting to go down to femtoseconds and below to study. So that's just a taste for the science at future XFELs, with a particular eye towards why attoscience might be a useful thing to explore. If you want to go back and see some of the details about the qualities of the light, there's the conceptual design report and the first experiments document online. Thanks very much.
What is the mechanism that means that the spikes of attosecond or sub-femtosecond emission that arise from the microbunches end up having such an irregular structure? You hinted that it wasn't like a regular train. I mean, is it fluctuating in separation or is it fluctuating in intensity between spikes?
Both, and it's basically gain switching, and so it's very, very much dependent on the random fluctuations in density of the and also position, actually, transverse position of the initial X-ray bunch. And in fact, I talked about one possible way to control this, but that was a way that doesn't include a laser. Most of the ways that Zollens will talk about all involve using a laser to pre-bunch the electrons. You don't really have to put very large density it's a laser, right? So if you want to see the laser, it doesn't take a lot of competition with spontaneous processes to do it. And so the idea here is quite similar to that idea with optical lasers, And that is, if we put rather small fluctuations, modulations, but controlled modulations in the density of the initial electron bunch, we can probably control to a large extent the positions of these spikes. Well, how do you do that? Well, there's lots of simple ways. You can co-propagate or counter-propagate a laser with the electron bunch just before it enters the undulator. You can filter. There are ideas about filtering. There are ideas also that are kind of more ambitious in terms of hardware, of starting with just an optical field that you have well controlled already, and then using that to seed a longer wavelength undulator that produces harmonics, and then using those harmonics to seed this sort of cascade process. I think Brookhaven studied that for a while, and that's also another technique. So there's no question that the sort of age of studying how to control the coherence of XFELs is really just at the beginning. It's also no question that when this thing turns on, it won't have any of that stuff installed. And so if we want to jumpstart the study of very, very fast phenomena, it's probably a good idea for us to think of clever ways to not need all of those extra insertion devices, which will eventually come.
Hey, I was just wondering if you would say something about the focusing of the X-rays and
right.
what sort of new issues will be coming up.
Yeah, first let me dispense with lambda cubed. We won't focus to lambda cubed. It's too bad, because if we could, then we could get up to this Schwinger limit. But in fact, what we will be able to do for sure is focus down to microns. And in fact, we would like to be able to focus down below a micron. So let's just say that, what if, let's just say that we could get down to 1,000 angstroms. Then we could get, that would be a focused intensity of 10 to the 23. I would say 10 to the 21 is going to absolutely happen. 10 to the 23 is going to only happen if it's a very, if we really understand everything very, very well with focusing. The method of focusing, by the way, for those of you who are kind of into X-ray stuff, it's not like an X-ray microscope at all, because we don't use zone plates because of their fragility, and they can't stand up to this kind of power. So these are our Kirkpatrick Baez mirror pairs. These are basically pairs of cylindrical mirrors for those of you who don't do X-rays. One in the horizontal, one in the vertical plane, and with different focal lengths so that they have a common focus downstream. Those will be in the initial experiment. So even so-called day one experiments, we expect to early on be able to do focused laser experiments down to micron, hopefully even submicron spot sizes.
Phil, for the multi-photon ionization part of the AMO experiments, are the cross sections fairly well known?
Yeah. For the experiments in the first experiments document, yeah, absolutely. We did things that were well known. I threw it out of this talk because I thought I was going to run. I actually had a slide that had all those numbers. So if you come to me right after, I'll just dig it out and we can go over it. But
so
yeah.
You would know selectively which OJ processes you might be able to outpace.
Yes.
Spike to spike or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yes. That, yeah, in order to make a credible story, of course, we worked all that out in the case of a krypton experiment, I believe it was, and have all that written down. Of course, the interesting thing will be to get beyond proof of principle experiments and to do this in systems where you really don't know whether you have such a long OJ lifetime, but we'll certainly start there. Commissioning, okay, well, there is a schedule, of course. Commissioning is fourth quarter of 08, calendar 08, and first light maybe a little before that. And then real operations starts in 09, probably summer or even fall of 09. And it'll start with the atomic physics experiments, partly because they're the least hardware intensive, but also partly for kind of quasi administrative reasons. That project has a jump start over the other project. So there'll be an atomic physics, and of course the question about the wavelength is important. It's a tunable device over a decade, and we'll start out, of course, at the long wavelength end. The formulas flash by fast, but you get the threshold much more easily at longer wavelength, and so we'll start out at around 800 eV, below a kilovolt, and so the early experiments will all be there. Now that's great because, as we atomic physicists know, our cross sections are much more favorable at longer wavelengths. So we'll be in a pretty good position to look at nonlinear atomic processes right off the bat. Eventually there will, but so that's an interesting point. So I didn't talk about I talked only about time domain here. But what about spectroscopy? Okay, and that's a good question. And in fact, the same noise that you see in the temporal domain, you see in the spectral domain. And so what will happen is that this will be a fairly narrow bandwidth device, not on the scale of the best monochrometers at the ESRF. It'll be on the order of, say, 10 to the minus 4 line width, something on that order. But the central frequency will not be the same on every shot. And the envelope of, you know, differences in central frequency over many, many shots is going to be more like 10 to the minus 3. So this is not a racehorse that is optimized for spectroscopy. It's simply not. And the ideas about how you might nonetheless get spectroscopic, you know, experiments out of it all involve some kind of filtering and shot selection so that you can basically only have signal when you're in the bandwidth that you want, or post-selection where you have signal all the time but you know what the frequency was on every shot. Right. You're right. You have harmonics. There's no question about it. And the second harmonic's actually very important for a lot of the diffraction experiments. They're going to really be happy that they have that. So there needs to be filtering. Actually, there needs to be filtering for other reasons. And the filtering will be done in the case of the high harmonics. The filtering will be done by grazing incidence mirrors. And then you have to worry about how good that is. But of course, and that depends on how large your two-photon cross-section is. And, you know, these issues are the kinds of details that are gone through in the first experiments document. But absolutely, the presence of the second harmonic is an important feature. The second harmonic is there in all undulator experiments.
Phil, you mentioned the repetition rate of your synchronization experiment. What's the rep rate of the accelerator?
120.
Of the FEL?
120.
Hertz?
Yeah, 120 hertz.
So you showed this biological molecule exploding over, I think it was 200 femtoseconds, and
right.
You said that in the early times, yeah, it looked like there would be a period, if the pulse was short enough, that you could deduce useful information. How short will the pulse have to be? What's the best estimate to actually get a useful diffraction pattern?
Right. And of course, the answer to that question depends on the definition of the word useful. Because, you know, you can get lower resolution information at longer times. And, you know, here you have to speculate on what's the difference between the spec and what it'll really do. And I think if we consider the compression of the electron pulse, which is already something that they've spent a couple of years working on as a guide, that chances are we'll have pulses that are more on the order of 50 to 80 femtoseconds on day one. The answer to the question of how short does it need to be in order to, say, do the best that you can do is it needs to be considerably shorter than that. That's a good thing. That means that not only us atoscientists, but also the imaging people are driving to try to make the pulse as short as possible, probably they need to get down to on the order of 10 in order to have really good resolution.
Well, we've had a long discussion, so I guess we can continue over lunch. So let's thank Phil for giving us a futuristic talk, and of course, the other speakers also.
Thank you.